Hello, and welcome to Prophetic Voices, Preaching and Teaching Beloved Community, a podcast from the Episcopal Church's Office of Reconciliation, Justice, and Creation Care, where we explore the season and the lectionary through the lens of social justice. I'm your host, Reverend Shaniqua, Staff Officer for Racial Reconciliation, and I'm so glad you could join us. In this episode of Prophetic Voices, we'll be discussing the Easter Sunday lectionary. Our amazing guests this week are the Reverend Shug Goodloe, who is from the Diocese of Missouri and is the Assistant Rector at St. Martin's Episcopal Church in Ellisville. She serves as the Missioner for Racial Reconciliation and Justice for the Diocese. Shug is married to wife Doris, and they have two daughters, Monica and Simone, as well as a granddaughter, Chloe. The wise Alan Murray, who is a member of Trinity Cathedral in Portland, Oregon. He is a godly play teacher, co-chair of the Asian Pacific Islander Caucus for the Deputies of Color, and an ambassador for the Episcopal Public Policy Network. He lives in Portland with his husband, their 7-year-old daughter, and two goofy beagles. And last but not least, the Reverend Peggy Lowe, who is currently the rector at St. Albans in Austin. She has been an organizer, translator, and nonprofit administrator. She is a passionate community member and wants our listeners to know that there are great vegetarian options in Austin. Welcome, friends.
Thank you so much for being willing to be guests on Prophetic Voices. It's great to have you here. What's important to keep in mind this Easter?
This Easter is a reminder that many congregations are emerging out of COVID pandemic. And for many congregations, this is actually the first time they are meeting in the full capacity without COVID restriction. And as we emerge out of the pandemic, I'm always mindful of the trauma that we have experienced in the last 2 to 3 years. Whether we want to acknowledge that or not, Easter is a reminder of new life, new creation. So what does that mean for us as a community, especially as a spiritual community emerging out of the pandemic? What does new creation and new life looks like for us? One of the gospel reading that is not included in this lectionary cycle is the Luke gospel about why are you looking for the living among the dead. And I think it is a good reminder for us as we enter this Easter season is that, are we looking for the living among the dead? Are we still having this nostalgia about what things used to be? Or are we able to embrace new possibility, new creation? Those are some of my thoughts about this to keep in mind this Easter.
Nice.
Yeah, and the whole notion of resurrection necessarily means that something must have died. To continue in your line of thought, Alan, we need to be thinking about not so much trying to get back to exactly like things were before COVID, but we need to consider what might we need to let die so that something else can live or grow. I think that's going to be very important for us this year. I had a friend who was an inspector for the fire department in the county of Los Angeles. And she explained to me about how they do some intentional burning and that burning is needed in order so that new growth can come about. I think about that in terms of the resurrection story. As you said, what do we need to let go of? Everything's not going to go back exactly like it was. And so what do we need to let go of so that something else might live? And what do we need to be watching for while we're doing that?
I've sort of had two images in my mind or two analogies. And one is the idea of Lent being the season we clear the field that is our minds. Our practice is all about removing the rocks and removing the weeds, and it prepares our minds and our hearts for the new seeds we want to plant in the Easter season. And so one line of thinking is to think about what is the seed that we want to plant. When we get to Easter, I'll be about at this church one whole year. And in this year, I've been thinking about how, you know, this church has been here, but it feels like we need to replant the church after COVID, asking ourselves who's here, who's not here. What is our mission coming out of COVID? What do we want to resurrect? What do we want to leave in the past? And so thinking about Easter as a season for planting and what is that new seed we want to plant? And the other image I've been having is this idea of a labyrinth. We have a labyrinth out here that folks can walk. And so Lent is sort of like slowly walking into the center and the idea of shedding baggage and weight we've been carrying around as we make our way toward the center. You know, the 50 days of Easter is about sort of walking out of that center and asking ourselves, what do we want to take on? What do we want to put back on as we re-enter the world or enter the next phase of the church year?
Peggy, you made me think of kenosis or whatever, like the emptying of oneself as we come out. So what liturgical suggestions do you have for this service? Some folks I know like dig up the alleluias that have been buried. There's like flowering the cross. So I know some folks want to do a whole procession around the church. What ideas do you have?
This is going to be my first real Easter at this church because I went there during COVID. From what I gather and from what I've seen so far and looking at old bulletins and so forth and so on, they do a little bit of everything. They really involve the children, of which we do not have that many in our congregation. They do a flowering of the cross, which they then use in the procession. This Sunday, we did have the children to color the alleluias, and then we, in children's chapel, and then took the children outside, and they assisted in the burying of the alleluias. So they will be dug up. What I haven't seen is anyone giving a whole lot of liturgical thought to what is going on. It's like they just kind of do these things because we do them kind of thing and not really giving any thought to it.
Mm.
So what I'm going to try to impart this year is that transition from the barren cross to have that represent like Good Friday and then that transition to Jesus's death and then the joyful celebration of his resurrection. You know, we're not just sticking flowers on a cross. There is a liturgical representation. There's a liturgical journey there. Even before COVID, that we were doing things just kind of by rote, you know. Oh, we always flower the cross. We always do this. We always do that. And not really think about it. I think that this reemergence out of COVID is the perfect time for us to really think about some things and to really feel some things and experience some things.
One of the things that our church did last year that I thought was really powerful during the Easter Vigil was that instead of just reading from the regular scripture on the story of salvation through history, all the reading, we actually used the godly place stories. We told the godly place stories, which is much more animated.
Yes.
And much more concise, accessible for children as well. And one of the image that I always love about the godly place story is the image of God became so close to us and we became so close to God. And that happens with the prophets and with Jesus. And that's something I hope that we will continue to do, which is to use the godly place story to tell the story of God's salvation in history. We did bury the Alleluia. I'm not sure where they'll bury, but on Shrove Tuesday, all the children and adults as well, we, besides having pancakes, we actually have Alleluia printed out on beautiful cards, and then the children can decorate them with stickers and drawings. And then we had a little procession into the sanctuary where we'll have a little liturgy. And at the end, we, you know, light the candle and we blew out the candle and we buried the Alleluias. And so that is, again, something that I'm looking forward to. And I have no idea where they are buried, so I'm excited to see how they're going to be emerging. But the whole story about Easter is really such a reminder that God is not done with us.
Right.
You know, God has came to us and became so close to us, and so that we can be close to God through the incarnation, through the crucifixion. And at the end, death is not the last word. And so there is this anticipation of new life and new energy, new possibilities. And that is what I want to go into Easter remembering those.
I think traditionally they've done a flowering of the cross here. That's part of the tradition. So I'm curious to learn a little bit more about that. And I like Reverend Shug's idea of, you know, maybe adding something onto it. And so maybe can invite them to write down the seed that they want to plant. And we can either have it all sort of stuck up on a wall so you can kind of see all the seeds that the people in the church want to plant. That might be one idea. The other too, thinking about Alan's comment about sort of grief from these last couple of years, I wonder if there's some kind of healing component between the services, just thinking, you know, while the kids are looking for their Easter eggs and folks are coming in having healing stations or something like that to just acknowledge all the hard things that people are struggling with.
I think we're planning on having some healing stations as well. One thing that I was really heartened by was that during the service, the rector announced that we would be, and she used the term, we would be burying the Alleluias. And at the end of the service, I had three kids that ran up to me and said, Reverend Shug, we want to bury them. Can we bury them? Is it just adults? And I said, oh, absolutely not. You can. Well, they wanted to go bury them by themselves. And we were like, maybe not. Then we probably wouldn't know where they were, Alan, you know.
Right.
You made me think about something else too. I'm talking about Lent, Peggy, and that we have a garden. The last 2 years, we've given about 3,000 pounds of produce to various, you know, food banks or Circle of Concern or whatever. I've always heard talk about what we gave, how many pounds we gave, and I've never heard any talk about the planting. Hmm. Never heard any talk about the seeds. Hmm. And so you really made me think about invoking those kinds of conversations as this time is coming around to be cultivating, to get people to understand the importance of thinking about the seeds and the planting. And I really appreciate that imagery.
Yeah, likewise, Peggy, I love how, you know, we can look at Lent and mm-hmm. Easter as a continuation mm-hmm. of a different season, but they are the same thing. One of the things that I love doing is during the pandemic was, since I have nowhere to go, which is to do a lot of gardening. You heard a lot of people doing COVID, you know, gardening. Mm-hmm. And so I learned a lot about growing tomatoes. And one of the things that I learned about growing tomatoes to have a really, really productive produce season is that you remove all the side shoots, they are not producing flowers. You remove all the leaves because a lot of energy is going into producing the leaves, and so that the energy can go into producing the fruit that you want. And that has become a guiding principle in my own spiritual practices, that what are the things that are distracting me? What are the things that are not going to be producing fruit in my life that I need to be tearing them off? The branch, and so that the energy can go into something that's more fruitful. So yes. That is a really good reminder of how Lent and Easter are all tied together in removing those distractions.
Over these last couple of years, I've just also thought about reminding folks that Easter is a whole season.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not just a day. And so it's like, what are you going to do for the 50 days, and what kind of resurrection are you participating in, or, you know, that you want to be part of enacting?
I was thinking too about how we think about it, right? Like, Shug, you talked about the church focusing on pounds of produce. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes in church, we focus so much on like the number of people on a Sunday. And I'm always curious to know, like, how many new relationships has our church built with people outside of our community? Or how many, like, think about different ways that we might quantify or qualify what we do that might be a different way of thinking about that.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you say that, and you focused on relationships outside of the church, but I had something happen. Last week, we had a parishioner who gave a presentation on Narcan at the adult formation. But she gave this wonderful presentation. We spoke about it during the announcements. And afterwards, one of the fellows in leadership at church came to me and he said, "Can you put me in touch with the woman that gave the presentation? I wasn't able to attend. I was thinking we'd like to invite her to have a booth or a table at our spring festival." And I looked at him and I said, "She's a parishioner." And he said, "She is?" Mm. And I was like, "Yeah." And the interesting thing is, I'm in a congregation where there's like 3 black people. So it's kind of hard to miss, you know, people of color. And he said to me, "Well, I have a tendency to just have tunnel vision," which means he didn't even turn his head this much, because he sits here and she sits like over here every Sunday. It got me to thinking about how we have to rekindle. Not even rekindle, because obviously he doesn't even have a relationship with this lady. If we can't even be in relationship with each other in our own space, how in the world are we going to do it outside? Mm-hmm. One of the things that I spoke about, we had Ashes to Go on Ash Wednesday. And one of the things that I spoke about was, don't just think about this day as, or this time during Lent when you have to give up something. Think about what you have to give, not give up. And think about being in closer relationship with God and your community, your neighbors, your family, whatever. There's so much that can grow out of this time, rather than thinking about just giving up something that I really want, although most people give up something they really don't care about in the first place. You know, I give up eating beets. Well, do you eat beets? No, not really. You know, how hard of a thing is that to do? Yeah, just getting folks to reconnect. And maybe this is a byproduct of COVID, because people have been keeping distance, not only physically, but I think in other ways. And so this may be something that we need to give attention to during this season as well.
Y'all talked a lot about planting and season. That made me think of the reading from Jeremiah. Jeremiah talks a lot about the prophecy calls for joy, dancing, and merrymaking. But it also says that the planter shall plant and shall enjoy the fruit, which I think is a comment maybe about time or the length of time. Not only do they get to plant, but they'll be around long enough to be able to enjoy it. Sometimes I feel like certain populations plant, but others are the ones who get to enjoy the fruit of their labors, maybe migrant workers or folks who aren't paid very well. Where have you seen that? And how might we as a church be called to change it? Or maybe think about what can we plant and what do we hope to see as fruit?
Well, and going back to scripture, you know, it talks about the intentional time of not bothering, you know, leaving something alone for three seasons, and the fourth year is for God, and then the fifth year, then we can enjoy it. But I can't help but think about what you're saying, Shaniqua, in terms of slavery in this country. The fact that all of these crops, all of this agriculture, all of this, the things that went on were done on the backs of people that were not allowed to enjoy the fruits of their labors. I kind of look at it in that context. And I think that to some extent, even though we may not even be talking about agriculture, that we're still talking about things being done on the backs of people that cannot enjoy the fruits of their labor. Think about how many people work, let's say, in the food service industry that can't afford to eat an expensive meal. The other church that I worked at in a very affluent area, and I got to noticing that you didn't see any public transportation after 3 o'clock. And then I realized, public transportation only runs between the times that the help comes in and the help goes out. And later did some research and found out that that was intentional. That was intentional. We don't want these folks in our community after 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And then they have to go back to communities where they cannot enjoy what they see every day in these communities that they work in. There's much to be done in that area. As you start researching, you start looking into these things, you see the intentionality of some of this. And that's what's disturbing, is the intentionality of it. And almost to the point of being callous for me. And not really regarding the humanity of people and the contributions that they make.
I've only been in Austin for a year. I don't know if some of you all saw recently in New Yorker, there was this article about somebody who had moved here maybe 20, 30 years ago, writing about how Austin has changed. It used to be a small town, or there are folks who really wanted to hold on to that small town ethos, but all around it was becoming a big city, but it didn't act like a big city. It feels like right now, the Bay Area is moving itself to Austin. Tesla's moving here, Google's built a giant headquarters downtown. And all I can think of is sort of what happened in around San Francisco as the tech boom happened. Folks who did the work, you know, the teachers, the, you know, everybody's having to move further and further out as the tech folks are moving in and driving up housing prices. Somebody in my congregation works with the music industry and works with sound, and Austin was known for its music scene. And what makes Austin, Austin is going to be gone or gradually going away, or only certain people who have the resources to keep living here can stay here and be part of the kind of Austin, the life and music and the great things about Austin that draw people here. You know, I just see that as a challenge coming down the line.
It reminds me of, Shook, what when you were saying about this country was really built on the backs of the slavery, the institution of slavery, and how we are continuing to reap the benefit on that institution. A few years ago, when I presented the resolution at a convocation meeting about truth and reconciliation, that we as a diocese really needs to start examining our complicity in our exclusion, because that is part of telling the truth, because without telling the truth, you cannot repair the breach. And one person asked me the question, why should he be responsible for what Winston Churchill has done? And I looked at him and said that nobody's asking you to be responsible for what Winston Churchill has done or what your ancestor did. But what we are asking you is to acknowledge that we continue to benefit from the white supremacy culture to this day. Our economic, our legal system, our legislative system, everything is built on the white supremacy culture. When we talk about racism, we are talking about it is systemic, it is institutional. And so it's going to take a lot of work to dismantle that system. And that makes people really, really uncomfortable when we start telling the truth. In my context, Portland, Oregon used to have the second largest Chinatown outside of San Francisco. And that got completely decimated during the Chinese exclusion. And here we build our prosperity and our infrastructure on the backs of the Chinese slaves who built the railroads. When they are done, sorry, you got to go. I continue to think about the legacy that we have inherited from that, you know, the Chinese exclusion. We no longer had a viable Chinatown in Portland. It is pretty sad looking, the old town. And with redlining, all the people of color were being distributed across the river to other parts of Portland. And so that's something to really reckon with, I think, this Easter. Is when God gives us that power, how do we use that power to dismantle the system?
One of the things I'm thinking about too is, you know, in South Dakota, we have surplus in our budget. And so we were like, this is a great time to take away the food tax. We have a food tax. And our legislature now has been voting to take down the tax as a whole across the board for everything, which isn't helpful because the people who are the poorest are would be the most impacted by this food tax. But I think that's what's going to end up happening. But I was thinking that was like a policy way of thinking about this too. How are we helping so that other folks can enjoy the fruit? Jeremiah also talks about saying, you know, it's time for joy and dancing and merrymaking. Where do you wish you saw more joy, dancing, and merrymaking in our church or in our communities?
Well, you know, in our diocese, we have 41 congregations. We have one congregation that is almost predominantly people of color, African American. We have recently a church plant, an African community. I think we call it Grace African Connections, and very recent, within the last couple of months. As I move around to places to preach or to speak at adult forums or whatever, if I want to hear some hand clapping and some foot stomping and some joyful noise, the only place I'm going to hear it is in that one community, All Saints Ascension, and then in the Grace African Connections. And then I've had people in my congregation and other congregations, which are all predominantly not people of color. Why can't we have music like that? I try to express who I am and my vestments. So, you know, I wear kente cloth. I wear mud cloth. I have icons in my office. I have iconography in my office that people see and always come. It always starts a conversation. I just always wonder, what is the reluctance to sing from Leave Us, or why are you afraid to say amen? I've had people tell me after I preach, oh, I really wanted to. Well, why didn't you?
Exactly.
If the Spirit moved you to do that, why are you so reluctant to do that? And so over the years, I've come up with this phrase that I use, and someone reminded me of it yesterday, and I call it the tyranny of tradition. It's like people are so bound by what they've always done. That they're reluctant to do anything else. And when somebody else does something a little different, then they look at the other person or the other people like they're interlopers, or they're like, what are you doing? We don't do that. It's a mystery to me. I think people are just so bound. I think there's a certain amount of elitism associated with the Episcopal Church. And I think people hold on to that. They want to be seen in a certain light. And there's certain things we do, and there's certain things we don't do. You know, I've asked the bishop twice when they've sent me to these congregations, do they know about me? Because they're going to see some things, and they're going to hear some things. We're not accustomed to seeing and hearing. For the most part, it's been well received, although with a fair amount of curiosity. And, you know, where did that come from? Well, it's a hymnal. Leave Us is a hymnal. And by the way, it's over there in the rack. Or it's in the pews or whatever, you know. Oh, real? Is that what that is? You know, so there's this kind of reluctance to really step outside of the box or the comfort zone. I love things like liturgical dance. I love getting some good old gospel choirs to come in. Our choir is really reaching out. I have to hand it to our music director, really reaching out. I think just about every Sunday we have at least one and possibly more selections from Leave Us. I frequently, when I'm doing morning prayer or other things, frequently pull from African proverbs and introduce different kinds of things into the language, and so people hear things and they see things. But I think we have to be willing to do that, to kind of pull people along.
Mm-hmm.
I think when you talk about liturgy and how white our liturgy is, we can't make any serious difference until we start decolonizing our liturgy in the Episcopal Church. We are part of the Anglican tradition, so we inherited the good, bad, and ugly. The style of worship that we inherited, which is still a very, very white way of worshiping, and that always is being perceived as the only way or the right way to worship God. Mm-hmm. Most congregations across the Episcopal Church have never heard about the hymnal Lift Every Voice and Sing. Most of them don't even own a copy of them. At least that's what I've been observing, you know, going to a lot of Episcopal churches. And if they do try to jazz it up and add a little bit, it almost seems sometimes cultural appropriation. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that our congregation does during Martin Luther King weekend or Black History Month is that they would throw in a song like Lift Every Voice and Sing. However, that is not being sung as an anthem is usually being used during a procession. And I always point out to people that is supposed to be a Black national anthem and supposed to be sung as an anthem while standing and not while moving. And so we really have a lot to think about how we decolonize our liturgy. And I don't have an answer to that, but it's something for us to wonder and to think about. How do we do that?
Right.
The way that I've been thinking about this question here about joy and dancing and merrymaking is I'm trying to build on what's here. So a month after I got here, folks are asking, you know, how are you doing? How are things going in your congregation? I'm like, it's great. They laugh at my jokes. Right. Just that willingness to laugh during the service. Like, I feel like in the churches that I've been in the past, that's like it's so hard to get any kind of reaction. And I love that they're just vocal about that. I think part of it, too, is thinking about Lent or, you know, this week, thinking about the sermon for the first Sunday of Lent and the Ash Wednesday liturgy, sort of almost reinterpreting words like penitence and fasting and self-denial, because people have very long associated, you know, repentance and penitence with shame and guilt and ashes and sackcloth. And to say that this is about bringing you closer to God, bringing you into closer to right relationship with God and your neighbors, for me in this congregation is sort of how I'm starting it, to preach with joy, to say that this is about love and life. Presiding Bishop Michael Curry talking about the way of Jesus being loving, liberating, and life-giving.
Yes.
And that was my theme throughout the Easter season last year. Of just every sermon, I went back to those three words, loving, liberating, and life-giving, that the way that we practice, the way that we live out our faith has to be that for ourselves and for those around us, right? Like, it doesn't do any good if it's liberating us, but not the folks around us, kind of like how Sabbath is not just for us, Sabbath is for everybody in our community. So the more that I think we can highlight those aspects of faith, the more that will move people into that feeling of joy, dancing, and merrymaking. So that's not just sort of during church socials. We had a great talent show as part of our show of Tuesday Pancake, and people had a lot of fun. But to say that, like, my faith is bringing me joy, as opposed to, you know, one of the kids asked at EYC on Sunday, you know, how does sin work? Does, like, one sin cause us to fall into hell? Or, like, there a certain number? Or how big is the sin? And I'm like, God's not keeping track. It's not a game. But, you know, that's where their understanding is, and that's what they're hearing.
Right.
So it's like, how do we, A, figure out, you know, what are they thinking when they show up to church? And how can we help recontextualize, reinterpret that for them in their lives?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there were four women walking down the street as we did Ashes to Go on Ash Wednesday. And just a hop, skip, and a jump from us is a big Catholic parish, St. Clair's. And these women apparently lived in the neighborhood and they were out for their morning walk and they stopped by and they literally stood and looked at me and they looked at Mother Leslie and they said, "Are you all priests?" And we were like, "Yes." And they got these big smiles on their face. And so we started talking about, again, our approach to Lent and being in closer relationship with God and being joyful and all of these things. And they looked at us and they said, "Well, can you give us ashes? Can you put ashes on us?" And we were like, "Of course we can." Just their willingness and the way they opened up, you could almost see these women blooming. First, that they saw these female priests.
Mm-hmm.
Second, that because one of them said, she said, "You mean I don't have to be feel like I'm being punished for the next?" And I said, "No." And so we had a conversation about that. But to your point, Peggy, it's what we exhibit, what we show. If we're walking around like we're flogging ourselves or whatever, you know, for the next 40 days, I think the way we live in the world says a lot.
Hmm.
I'm a former Catholic, and my parish priest, and unfortunately, he's the gentleman that was just killed in outside of Los Angeles, Bishop Dave O'Connell.
Hmm.
You could see the joy out of this man. When you went to that church, it was like it was just spilling out of him. And I've never forgotten that. It's like we can live in a world in that way. We can show this to other people. You can do this without even talking sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
What is that saying? Preach the gospel and if necessary, use words. Right. But sometimes it's not necessary to use words.
Yeah.
Think about Presiding Bishop Curry. We went to the Good News Festival in San Diego, and they were talking about the podium. And I said, "Oh, that's cute." I said, "Y'all know he's not going to use that, right? He's going to be all over the place." You know, he just exudes joy and enthusiasm and love. You know, if only we could all be that way. Just fabulous.
We had to do Ash Tuesday, like at our Shrove Tuesday, because of the storm. We just asked them if they wanted it, and they said yes. So we did it quick, and there was like a bunch of kids there who are unchurched, and they were there because their grandma brought them or something. And one of them was like, "What's ashes? How does it work?" I just had to like quick think on my toes, and it made me think of joy because I was like, "Well, this is like the YOLO day of the liturgical year," and I was like, "It's like, you know, it reminds us of our mortality and that you only live once. And so we have to make sure that we love people and show that love to each other because we only have this one life to live." And so I was like, had they said, you know, "You need to prepare a children's sermon," I would have never thought of YOLO. I've been deep in like theological mess, busy thinking too much or too hard. And I was like, it just kind of popped out right then. But so we were able to find joy, and he was very excited. He wanted the ashes. He wanted to ash his brothers. All very interesting. The other thing I was thinking about as we were talking about like decolonizing the liturgy and maybe where our church comes from is, I remember talking about that in seminary, like the European English sort of style is very much emotions are meant to be controlled, right? Everything's meant, and that's why in church people like they sit and they don't react. And when you preach, like sometimes I'll preach and ask a question, they just stare and it's like crickets. Or you need to tell a joke and it's crickets. In Black congregations that I've been in or Native congregations, you can tell a joke and they laugh, and they sometimes will, they'll do the amens and the mm-hmms when, you know, when you're preaching. And it's because in those cultures, emotions aren't meant to be controlled. They're meant to be expressed. I think that's maybe the challenge that we're seeing too, as to where we could find joy is how can we be more authentically ourselves and not see emotions necessarily as something to be controlled, but maybe something to be lived into.
Yeah, when I was a kid, go to church with my grandmother, she was Baptist. I couldn't have been more than 5 or 6 years old, and they were just having a grand old time, and the pastor said, talking to me, "Why don't you stand up and pray for us?" And I was like, "Oh, Lord, you know, what am I going to do? I'm 5 or 6 years old, I don't know." And I literally, my grandmother told this story till the day she died. I stood up and started praying, and all I could think of was words from commercials I had seen on TV. I started talking about Jesus being good to the last drop and all of this, you know, because I'd heard that on a coffee commercial. And at first I thought my grandmother was horrified. Oh, you know, I just embarrassed her terribly. But the joy that those people exhibited and me just equating, I guess, God to some of these things that I was familiar with. I always have remembered that, how, like you say, these expressions of joy, this, you know, hallelujah, amen,
mm-hmm.
preach. I just wish we did more of that in our congregations.
Mm.
And our children needs that. About a month ago, we had a ecumenical and interfaith event at the Temple Beth Israel, which is a large Reformed synagogue near our cathedral. It was in commemoration of the Martin Luther King Jr. And so we had a Shabbat worship with a gospel choir.
Mm.
And so you want to talk about interfaith and ecumenical at its best. And I brought my daughter, who is 7, to the event. And one of my parenting philosophy is that I don't try to shield and protect my daughter from difficult stories.
Hmm.
I try to tell her at an age-appropriate way what slavery meant, what the Holocaust meant, and all the different difficult, painful stories of our history. And I was so pleasantly surprised that she sat through a 2.5-hour service without any difficulty. I couldn't even get her to sit still for 30 minutes in church, but for her to sit through a 2.5 service. And so I asked her what was different and what do you like best about the service. She said she really loved the music. So I know she's a big fan of gospel choir right now. And our children really need that kind of joy, to experience that kind of joy, and not just to experience worship as something to be tolerated and that you are supposed to be at your best behavior. And so I think it really expanded her view of what joy can look like in a place of worship.
Nice. So let's shift and talk about the Gospels. There's two. Jürgen Moltmann said, without women preachers, we'd have no knowledge of the resurrection. What does it mean that it was women who first learned of Jesus' resurrection?
I mean, the first thing that came to mind was that it's another reversal that he's enacting, right? So death is not the end. Life is, you know, who has authority? It's the woman, right? That's a common thing in all the Gospels. It's the women who went to the tomb. They didn't just talk about it. They showed up.
Yeah, not only that, it wasn't a woman that sent Jesus into the tomb. He wasn't in the tomb because of women. You know, who really believed? Who was caring? Who was all of those, you know, kind of nurturing things that we think about?
Right. Who didn't give into despair?
I think of it things kind of a little differently. Like Jesus is like, I don't need them waiting outside. They're the ones that got me in here in the first place. I don't need those dudes out there. I'm going to need some women out there because I know what the dudes will do for me. It gives me great comfort now to know that there were women there. And talk about joy. It gives me joy, not only comfort, but great joy to know that.
The resurrection story, especially with the woman being the first one to realize that Jesus rose from the dead, is to really highlight, you know, and to confront us and remind us that God's new creation and God's reign is really about turning everything upside down. It also reminds us that, you know, scriptures have so many examples of women who speaks prophetically. These women were always the very low in the totem pole of the society. And God is trying to change that power structure, and that these women were bold, they were courageous, they were even subversive. Imagine Mary, you know, an unwed teenage mother-to-be, you know, who can proclaim that, just saying that from now on, all generation will call me blessed, and that God has shown the strength of her arm and scattered the proud in their conceit. You know, God has cast down the mighty from their thrones and lifted up the lowly. That is pretty subversive to say in the first century, especially from a woman. And so I love that part of the resurrection story, is that women were the first one.
And just to comment on the totem pole comment, the most prominent position on the totem pole is the one nearest the door. So when you say low person on the totem pole, it's actually, that's the best position, just FYI. Like, people use that statement all the time.
Interesting.
They might have been courageous, but they might have been afraid too. And it can be both at the same time and can hold those tensions at the same time. Just thinking about that and all the tensions that God invites us to hold so that we can show up.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah, I don't think courage is the absence of fear. I think it's, I'm afraid, but I'm going into this anyway.
Yep. It's doing what is right, even though you are afraid. In the Matthew verse, there's all this talk about Galilee, and it's like, go to Galilee, Jesus in Galilee. I feel like Galilee paid for advertisement in Matthew's gospel or something. What do you think that's about?
Didn't it have to do with a prophecy, like fulfilling a prophecy, because Matthew is all about Jesus fulfilling prophecies?
Yeah, like, go ahead to Galilee. I feel like if I was like the gossip columnist at the time, I'd be like, ooh, everything's going on in Galilee. Y'all got to get down there. This is where it's happening this weekend or whatever. Come see Jesus.
And now that we talk more about it, I'm like, I think of the Sea of Galilee, you know, and I think about Capernaum, which is on the banks, on the shores. And my mind is having trouble, like, trying to jump straight to, like, where Galilee is. Go and tell my brothers to go to Galilee. There they will see me. Why didn't Jesus just show up where his brothers are? They didn't come to the tomb, so they also have to make some kind of journey to where Jesus is. Jesus in the Gospels often asks people if they want to be healed. He didn't just walk around saying, you know, you're healed and you're healed. People had to come seek him out, right? I think there's a little bit of sense of that here. Like, you have to make some effort. You have to meet me partway. I've come so far to meet you. You have to meet me partway.
Mm.
I also wonder whether this is a reminder of where all things started at the beginning. The disciples who were still afraid and perplexed, and who is this Jesus who is new, but to remind them that this is the same Jesus who did all this ministry, you know, in Galilee. So I just wonder about that.
So let's shift and talk a little bit about John. John is one of the ones that I think about when I think about where, like, she here Jesus is talking to her and she doesn't realize it's Jesus.
Right.
And the example that I always use when I preach on this is I'll talk about dandelions. Like, if you see the dandelion when it's yellow, and then you see the dandelion when it's all gray, and you know you're about to blow it to fling the little seeds everywhere. It's the same plant, but if you didn't see it transition, you wouldn't know it's the same plant. And I wonder if Jesus kind of maybe was like that somehow. Has there ever been a time when you've seen the Lord or seen or experienced something sacred but didn't know it at first?
I mean, I always tell the story of how it came to be at Grace Cathedral, which is the first time I'd seen it was when my cousin had her 21st birthday at a tiki bar across the street at the Tonga Room. You know, I just remember we walked from the parking lot to where she was having her birthday party and this giant church. And then it was 8 or 9 years later when I was started thinking about, you know, I want to go back to church. I didn't know that much about denominations. I didn't want to end up back in a sort of fundamentalist church that I had gone to when I was in high school. I just remember, you know, 8 or 9 years ago, I walked by this building. I wonder what it is. And so I Googled Tiki Bar San Francisco, went on Google Maps, and I was like, yep, I remember there was a park, and across the park, yep, there's a church. They posted the sermons on iTunes. So then I went on iTunes and started listening to the sermons. I couldn't have known that first time I walked by that that place was going to be so important to me.
I think when I look at my own spiritual journey, there were times that obviously when God spoke so loudly and clearly, you know that that's from God. And I look at my own conversion experience, you know, I was Buddhist for many, many years. And so I did not convert to Christianity until my late teenage years, early adulthood. I converted to Catholicism. I was baptized actually and confirmed in the Catholic Church as an adult. And that journey took me into so many different paths. And that is when I started wrestling with my own sexuality and knowing that the Catholic Church would not be hospitable to me. So what I did was went to an Assemblies of God church because, you know, they really believe in the power of the Spirit. Maybe they can remove that spirit of homosexuality from me. So I dabbled into the Pentecostal church for several years. But deep down, there's always this longing and craving for sacraments, for liturgy that was so missing. So it wasn't until I went to graduate school and I ended up in a place, a Methodist church that was welcoming, that I was able to do some spiritual healing. And then eventually met some students who were Episcopalian who introduced me to the Episcopal church. And that is when I started to find home. So when I look back at my own spiritual journey, it was like it wasn't clear at that moment that that was God. It seems like I couldn't make up my mind. Where am I going to? I was searching for something that I couldn't find. And it was at the end of that journey that I realized that God was there in each of the ways that I was taking. I was afraid. I was anxious. But when I look back, I was like, I finally came home. And that was really where God was.
Yeah, I had experience similar to yours in some regards. At a very early age, my mother remarried. You know, I was probably 8, 9 years old, and the fellow that she married was not at all fond of me. And subsequently, I started suffering various forms of abuse at the hands of this man, which caused me to want to find a hiding place in the house. And so I found this place to hide. It was quite cramped and quite dark. It was literally behind a wall that I had found out was hollow on one side. And I'd get behind and pull this wall, and it was pitch dark in there. And I've always been claustrophobic. And as a kid, I was a little afraid of the dark. But this was preferable to me than being able to be found. I'm in this dark space, and I realize there's a light. And I'm saying, where is that light coming from? And it's a little, just a little piercing light. I said, I can't understand where this is coming from, because I knew it couldn't have been coming from the other side of this wall, because I knew what was there. And I became afraid that if this light was coming from someplace, that meant I could be found, because there was some breach there. And I was really, really, really upset about this light. And all of a sudden, something came to me, and to this day, I say it was the voice of God, and it said, the light is coming from within you. That's really started my real relationship with God, which changed over. I mean, I went through Catholicism and then I left the Catholic Church, you know, for various reasons. And then my wife, who was already Episcopalian, introduced me to the Episcopal Church. Almost didn't happen because she took me to Rite One service first. So it was like, so she recognized that, oh, I better take her to a Rite Two service. So,
oh my.
You know, since then, certainly understand the beauty of the Rite One service. That moment sticks out in my mind as my real conversion and my real understanding of the light that's in all of us that comes from God. And it also made me feel very loved by God because I thought, oh, God gave me this light in this darkness, you know, and it's not a light that anybody can extinguish. It's not a light that can be taken away from me. And so that kind of was the beginning of my real understanding of feeling like I really encountered God.
Something that I think I noticed or I remember is like growing up, my grandpa was a priest and I only ever saw him when I was really young dressed as a priest, like he had his collar on and stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I associated, you know, you're holy if you have, well, of course, this is me and my childish theological things, but like you're only holy if you have that collar or if you're dressed up. And then seeing him like in the garden and seeing like he was still very, like he'd be in the garden in his t-shirt and jeans and stuff. And then I also saw Lakota Medicine Man later when I lived with him and his wife. And they would just be in like torn t-shirt and, you know, jeans with dirt on them. And a lot of them were like ranchers and stuff. Later that I realized, oh, these are holy people too. And holy people can look like us or like me. Who are you in the resurrection stories? It could be either gospel, I guess, but who are you in the story? Sometimes I think I'm the crowd trying to crucify Jesus. Sometimes I feel like Mary Magdalene, where I'm like, I don't get it. I'm just doing this thing and we're just doing it. And then I'm like, what happened? You know, who are you?
I don't know that I've ever identified who I am because I've thought about this a lot. What I have thought about was what would I have done had I been in the crowd?
Okay.
And I actually preached this not too long ago and I had people come to me and say, oh, well, I certainly wouldn't have been the one to drive the nails and I wouldn't have been the one to do this and I wouldn't. But what I say is, yeah, but you're thinking about it in terms of today.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know what you would have been compelled to do back at that time during, as part of the crowd. That whole notion of the crowd is one that really lately is just really kind of rolling around in my head. And what would I have done? You know, I think about what Martin Luther King did, knowing that he probably was going to be killed.
Mm.
I think about the four folks that were killed down in Mississippi, you know, as a result of being on this, in the civil rights movement. And mm-hmm. I think I saw something not too long ago about the treatment of Chinese people that were building the railroad and how they weren't really afforded good health care and stuff. Like if they got sick or injured, well, we don't need you anymore. And just kind of cast people aside. I think we have to take ourselves out of today's circumstances and today's thinking to wonder about who we would have been. I can tell you there are times that I felt crucified myself in my life.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you that.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then that speaks to resurrection again, because I can also tell you that I definitely have been resurrected from those times.
Hmm.
I think I would like to see myself as being Mary Magdalene, who has that courage, but with a lot of fear and confusion. I see myself more as the other disciples. It's like, show me. I don't believe this. Like Thomas, I need to touch you before I could believe it. For me, these really serve as really good examples for me to reflect on who I will be if really put in the resurrection story. You know, there's something powerful about that transformation that happens in the resurrection story. It is about something old and something new, because Mary Magdalene did not even recognize Jesus.
Hmm.
You know, there is something old, but yet there's something new about Jesus that nobody recognizes him. That is just such a powerful image for me about what transformation looks like.
Hmm.
It's aspirational for me in my spiritual journey to be at that place.
Thinking about us today, and then do we recognize? Is it right here and we don't see it?
Hmm.
Do we have to touch the wounds to be able, do we have to do that? What does it take? Those are questions I wrestle with.
Mm-hmm.
Given our conversation just now about joy, I wonder if I'm one of the two angels in white asking people, why are you weeping?
Mm-hmm.
I've never put myself in one of their roles, but I think based on how they describe them with like these awesome clothes and like shimmering stuff, I'm like, that would be awesome. The clothes were like lightning. That'd be like the best drag outfit ever.
Then we have to come up with a good name for you then.
Yeah. Shinista or something.
When I preach on the transfiguration, I had connected to the robes that we wore our baptism to Jesus's white robes after his transfiguration. Mm. Invited folks to think about how our baptism calls for us to be transformed and transfigured.
That kind of bothers me a little bit. How come it had to be white? Yeah, in the beginning, everything was dark. Then light came. It all came out of darkness. So darkness couldn't have been all that bad. That whole imagery of everything angelic and good having to be white is just a recurring theme that is still bothersome to me. I certainly understand why that's done, but it's still very bothersome to me.
I think at the time, the people who were talking about it, they were all brown and tan. So they didn't even have an idea of a white, you know what I mean? Like they didn't have an idea of a white person to talk about from that context.
Right.
So what tips do you have for preaching Easter Sunday? The one that sort of, Alan, you sort of came to me as you were talking was this idea of old and new and transformation. And I was thinking about the transformation I've seen from people in recovery. Like, for example, some of my relatives who've been addicted to methamphetamines and then they went to treatment and they got out and they recovered. And they're still the same person. Like there's the old person that you always knew, but then there's the new person that's so joyful and vibrant and doesn't look like death when you see them, and how much more a life they can live, it seems like.
I just kind of had three very short like bullets, you know. It's like, be not afraid and don't look for the living among the dead and expect something new. Those are the three things that keep coming to my mind. Resurrection stories in the gospel is do not be afraid and don't look for the living among the dead. So let's let go of some of the things that needs to die so that life can come through and really expect something new.
I kind of would say, like, refuse to stay dead. Encourage people to resurrect whatever is dead in their lives. Jesus lives among us. I always try to remind people that Jesus is not just a historical character, like in some people's minds, but also a living being here with us every day. And to remind people of that, despite the crucifixion, despite some other things that have happened, Jesus lives. Jesus is here with us today in this very moment.
Early this year, I read a book called Shalom Sisters by Oshetta Moore. And she talked about telling a better story. And she didn't explicitly draw this connection, but it made me think about the good news as the reason or the way we can tell a better story. A better story of who we were created to be, what we were created for, to think about our original belovedness and not original sinfulness. All the stories, right? All the myths that are being told in society today, whether it's the myth of meritocracy or the myth of self-sufficiency or the myth of normalcy, right? Mm. And Jesus is here to tell us a better story that we are beloved as we are, and we are called to not just tell that story about ourselves, but about who we can be as a people.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for sharing your good news today and your wisdom. I appreciate you taking time to be with us for this episode of Prophetic Voices. And Christ is risen.
The Lord is risen indeed.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you want to learn more about Beloved Community, visit episcopalchurch.org/beloved-community. Thanks to our guests, Shug, Ellen, and Peggy. Thanks also to our production team, especially Chris and Asma. If what you heard today resurrected something in you, please rate, review, and of course, share our podcast. That's it for this season of Prophetic Voices, but look for our special Creation Care episodes coming up soon. Until next time, let your light shine.
You're invited to join thousands of Episcopalians, neighbors, and friends this summer at the Love Always Revival at the KFC Yum Center in Louisville, Kentucky. On Saturday, June 22nd, get immersed in inspiring worship and community, deepen your love for God, kick off the 81st General Convention, and extend a warm welcome to folks discovering the Episcopal Church. The revival is free to attend, so bring your friends. If you're from a neighboring diocese, check in with your diocesan revival champion to find out about group travel options. You can find more information along with registration at iam.org/lovealways.